This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program exclusively on Aspen Public Radio, where we talk with the musicians, composers, movers, and shakers at the Aspen Music Festival and School. Support for summer classical music programming on Aspen Public Radio is provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. And this is our first festival showcase of the 70th season of the Aspen Music Festival. So let's start with a conversation with President and CEO Alan Fletcher and Vice President for Artistic Administration and Artistic Advisor Asadura Santurian about the upcoming season and the theme being American. Later, we'll also chat with pianist Joyce Yang about her upcoming performance of the Gershwin Piano Concerto. Here's Alan and Asadura. Alan and Asadura, I'm glad you could both come in to visit us here at Aspen Public Radio. Being American is quite a theme, and I think it includes a lot of people, the emigres who have come over the last century especially, and then, of course, people who were born here in America. Can you say just a little bit about the theme and how it weaves through your season?
Sure. I think the theme began because it's our 70th anniversary season, and so we were thinking about our place in the development, if you will, of American music. And Aspen has played a major role. And as you mentioned, the emigre composers, Stravinsky and Millot and Messiaen and Britten and so many came in the early days up to the mountains. So we have a very proud tradition in terms of American music. We were asking a question, which so many have asked before, which is, what does American music sound like? And I think most music lovers would have a concept of what French music sounds like, or German. Ned Roram very famously says all American composers are either French or German at their heart. But what Russian music sounds like, what Czech music sounds like, what Italian music sounds like, these things are well understood, but not so much American. So is it jazz? Is it Broadway? Is it Aaron Copland? Is it hip-hop? Is it Samuel Barber? Is it Philip Glass? By the end of the summer, I hope the audience will say, it's all of those things. And we had wonderful...
We are the melting pot.
Yes, exactly. We had wonderful examples of all of those genres. But we're also exploring the fact that American music is very much the creation of people from other cultures. And people who came to this country looking for opportunity and brought their own ideas about what music can be with them.
Asadura, did you want to add anything to that about, I guess, what being American means to you as somebody who is so deeply involved in the programming this season?
Alan does such a wonderful job of encapsulating the meaning behind being American. The only thing I could possibly add is that the festival itself is an American festival with an international reach, meaning our community here this summer will constitute or be comprised of North Americans, South Americans, as well as Europeans and Far Asians. So over the 70 years, the festival has developed a wide and deep and far reach in the world.
I know you have at least Sharon Nisbin with Jessica Rivera singing Latin American music with guitar, which we also associate a lot with Latin America or Spanish. Do you have a fair amount of music from Mexico, from Central America, from South America represented on your program this season?
Well, yes, we have tried in the definition of the word festival to be a sampler for as much as we could reasonably and musically and artistically incorporate into our programming, as wonderful students in our audiences will be studying the calendar and attending concerts will be telling us over the summer.
We also have a wonderful work by Gabriela Lena Frank, which is Peruvian.
Well, I'm sitting here right in front of an American composer, and every year Alan gets some of his music is programmed, and I wanted to know what you're planning on having this year that, in a sense, represents you as a composer. And also, from there, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the fact that I believe you were educated primarily here in the United States, and that was not really possible. America didn't really have the educational system we have. When did that happen? When was it possible to become fully trained as a classical artist here in the United States?
Well, so thinking about teaching of composition in the U.S., Edward McDowell was the first person ever to be a university professor of composition. That was at Columbia University. But Princeton didn't start giving degrees until the late 30s. And my own teacher, Roger Sessions, was actually the person who did it. There's a sweet story about a faculty meeting at Princeton when they were debating giving the PhD mm-hmm. in composition. And Arthur Mendel, who was otherwise a wonderful person, a brilliant Bach scholar, said, "You cannot tell me that Beethoven would have needed to earn a PhD in composition." And Roger Session said, "When Beethoven came to Princeton, he would not yet have been Beethoven." So that happened in the mid-century. And I would say, you know, Aaron Copland's generation, it really felt necessary to them to go abroad and to study. And then the generation right after, not so much. The people who were Roger Session's students and Paul Hindemith's students, people in the Stravinsky-Schoenberg orbit as well.
Do you feel that this is where America really found its voice then, is when we had not just the dispensing of PhDs, obviously, but the fact that whatever kind of apprenticeship existed in music, it was all here for
Yeah, it's a necessary condition, possibly not sufficient, but but absolutely necessary that you should be able to get that training. You know, really the same was true for instrumentalists, whereas most of the great conservatories were founded in a wave right after the Civil War. New England Conservatory, Oberlin, Eastman, Juilliard came later, Curtis later. But still, there was an idea that one went abroad to be finished. And the moment that begins to change, possibly with Van Cliburn himself, who was entirely American-trained, that was a turning point.
Can you speak about your experiences? You see yourself, I'm sure, as an American composer, born here, trained here. Are there aspects of your musical language that you feel in some way are uniquely American?
Well, first, since I mentioned Ned Rorem before, I'll say that when I was a student, Ned came to Juilliard and was giving a class, and I was the one presenting my own music. So he heard a piece of mine, and he said, "So, young man, do you think you're French or German?" Because that's what he always did to people. And I said, "Oh, German, for sure, because Roger Sessions, Milton Babbitt, these are all very much in the German tradition." And he said, "You can wish all you want, but you will never be anything other than French." And it took me a long time to come to grips with that. Now I think Ned was totally correct. So, yeah, American. You know, I have used jazz elements. A piece I have this summer on the Final Friday actually has a quote from Eminem in it. There's a hip-hop element in there. At the same time, I do love that central tradition of Samuel Barber and Aaron Copland, and I just completely love their music. So I hope there's something of that in my own music.
It seems to me also that American composers, in some ways, were the ones who found a way out of the Stockhausen, the extremely difficult, you know, Pierre Boulez, the music that is difficult for audience to comprehend. That music has great value. But it seems like it was the Americans that were coming back with music that was touching people and touching audiences again in a uniquely American way that didn't happen in Europe at that time.
Well, I mentioned Samuel Barber and Aaron Copland. Composers like that were always present. There was there was never a moment where extreme atonality took over American music. Now, my own teachers were atonal composers, but I often say to young composers, Roger Sessions and Milton Babbitt, Elliot Carter for that matter, never suggested once that I should write atonal music or asked me to or talked about 12-tone music. In fact, not a single lesson did we ever talk about 12-tone music. And I was always writing tonal music and they were always helping.
I want to ask also the vocal music. I have an opera show back in Boulder and I did a feature on Aspen and what they're doing vocally for the summer. And it was a long list. And one of the things that really struck me was that you have a Sondheim musical and South Pacific, Rodgers and Hammerstein. Can you say a little bit, either one of you, about why you've chosen to bring that much musical theater, I guess you might say, into the opera program this year?
Well, for me, the sound of Broadway is one of the truly authentic American sounds. And we couldn't have an American season if we didn't include that. We have a wonderful cabaret evening as well. And then we have the symphonic dances from West Side Story. So we have, as you say, a lot of Broadway, but it is a uniquely American sound.
I want to ask also about emigres. And I don't know, either one of you can pick this up, but America unfortunately benefited enormously from the horrible tragedies, World War I and then especially World War II, and then just other people just coming over even after that too. Can you say a little bit about those composers who were thoroughly grounded in their French or their German or their Russian origins and then came to the United States and found a way to express that?
There were different strands there because a composer like Stravinsky, of course, made his home in America, but his music didn't change. His music doesn't become American in some way. Schoenberg is the same way, whereas Kurt Weill really adopted an American idiom and became, to my mind, truly an American composer in his time here. I might put Hindemith with those other ones who didn't seem to
have... stayed Germanic.
Yes, definitely. Didn't seem to have become anything except Hindemith. And Bartok, who was only in the U.S. briefly and unhappily, but very productively musically. But all of those people that I mentioned had a tremendous impact on American composers. And they were available to and interested in American composers. They all really took an interest. You know, Hindemith was the most obvious teacher in that whole group, but all of them had their disciples.
Well, I know that we're not going only and exclusively into American. You have a lot of Beethoven and Mozart, and you got Baroque music. One of you like to talk about some of the other musical strands that find their way through that don't fit into that theme.
Well, I want to comment about the foreign national composers who have made the United States their home. Vivian Fung, her string quartet, will be performed this summer. Kati Agush, her concerto for violin and percussion orchestra, will be performed this summer. Certainly Vijay Iyer, a prominent voice in several genres of music, not just classical. A work of his commissioned on the anniversary of Rite of Spring will be performed. It's a holy rite called Rade Rade with film. So these are folks who have brought their own individuality and are making the U.S. their home. And I can't imagine that some of each of their worlds is not present in their current contemporaneous compositional voice. And then we have non-immigrants who are also represented through the summer, including our two composers in residence, Stephen Hartke and Christopher Theofanidis, in a work each. And Wynton Marsalis, his violin concerto for Nicola Benedetti, will be performed. There's a great deal of variety in the names I've mentioned and the kinds of music they're writing, but they all have a lyrical bent to them. Alan will also have a work for trombone choir, which very much has its roots in Americana as well. It's really a terrific summer for living composers. But as you mentioned, there is a storehouse of works on every orchestral series, in every recital, beautifully curated with the aid of either the guest conductors or the guest artists to individualize these programs to them, but also serve the needs of our students and our audiences throughout the summer. And plenty of Beethoven, Brahms, Tchaikovsky, Sibelius. We're thrilled that Leonard Slatkin will be back this summer in the heartwarming Enigma variations of Edward Elgar, and debuts galore throughout the summer.
We have Mahler 7, which is the first. We have definitely not had a Mahler 7 in my 14 summers.
That's right. I would say in several decades.
And a Mahler 2.
Yeah.
And a Mahler 2.
Oh,
so
yes,
we are coming to the end of our Mahler cycle. Maybe we'll start another one.
You know, I wanted to mention, because we talked about the waves of emigration in the 30s, people fleeing fascism in Europe. But there was also a wave of people leaving Eastern Europe and Russia around the turn of the 20th century, also because of discrimination. And the families of Aaron Copland and George Gershwin and Irving Berlin were in those groups. And so there was a tremendous importance to American music of people who were fleeing the pogroms.
I want to ask, you know, Robert Spano is very involved, of course, with what's it called, the Atlanta School, I think, of composers. And of course, he does a lot with the conducting students. I don't know how involved he is with the composing students. What hand has he played in bringing this American programming together, too?
He's definitely the third spoke. He's not here, but he's very much engaged, and he's a partner in the evolution of the summer season, any given summer season.
Does he work with the composing students?
Oh, yes. You may know that the Academy Orchestra is the orchestra for the composition readings. And then later in the summer, we have a composition workshop where some of these things are delved into in depth. Some of the new works are examined closer with some suggestions from our faculty as to what might be suggested to the composer to consider. And it's very proactive. This is a brainchild of Robert and Alan, and they're very much present and involved with our composers in residence.
Each student composer is paired with a student conductor, and the conductor prepares the piece. And as Ossiter says, Robert spends a lot of time working with them.
That's right.
I might mention, I've seen these before, and they're free. And I find it very exciting because, especially if you go to the one, you have the first one where it's kind of a first run through, and then they get their suggestions. And sometimes the orchestra will play what was composed first, and then what improvements were suggested that the
precisely that up. Whole suggestion comes from Robert, Alan, Christy Ofanidis, Stephen Hartke, and if there are other guests we've invited, they powwow with the composers and make their suggestions. Of course, the composer is free to accept or decline these suggestions, but sometimes, of course, they accept and we listen to both versions. And
so it's a very exciting thing to do. It's at odd hours, like Mondays at 9 a.m. or something.
Sunday at 9 a.m. Look on the calendar because it is fun and it's free.
The calendar, by the way, can be almost scary. What do you have, 300 concerts in 8 weeks or something like that?
Well, just go a week at a time. Then it's not so scary.
And we'll help you through here at Aspen Public Radio, I promise. I'll let you know day after day and week after week what's coming up to kind of point you in some interesting directions there. Tell us a little bit about the emerging artists that you have among your students, which
I'd
is
like
really
to
important.
Draw attention to our spotlight concerts, some of which will be in Harris Hall. And these are free. They are showcasing students. We take care to showcase the whole range of students. So from piano to strings to brass to winds to harp, small groups, large groups, solo.
And they're throughout the summer, Wednesdays and Thursdays in Harris Hall at 2:30. But we're also in the community, Pitkin County Library, as well as the community church, the Aspen Chapel, the Physics Institute, and all of these are listed. We even send them to the Basalt Regional Library and the Carbondale Library. So our students are everywhere, not just the street corners, but in concert, prepared and coached by our faculty for these events.
Before I let you go, I think we've covered the most important things, but do either of you have any inspiring or entertaining stories that you might want to talk about? You're a great storyteller on stuff, when you're...
He is a great storyteller.
I will talk about my trombone piece. It's three movements for eight trombones. It started with an idea from Per Brevik, who's been on our faculty longer than anyone else, 43 years, I think, now. Per teaches at Juilliard, and so he said, we always have eight or so fantastic trombone players at Juilliard. Why don't you write a piece for eight trombones? And at first I thought, really? Then I just fell in love with the idea. It's, on the one hand, very much like men's chorus sound and the fantastic repertoire that exists for glee clubs. Also, my older brother, who was once involved with drum and bugle corps, listened to the piece and said, it's really like a horn line in a drum and bugle corps. So very much Americana. That is July 8th in our regular Monday faculty chamber music concert at 6 p.m.
Alan Ossiter, thank you so much for sharing the excitement of the beginning of our season. And we may chat with you a little bit more later in the season, but I'll see you both at the tent and at Harris Hall and at the Opera House and all over the place.
Great. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
A great pleasure.
If you've just joined us, we've been talking with Alan Fletcher and Ossiter Santurian about the upcoming Aspen Music Festival season. And now let's hear from pianist Joyce Yang, who talks about Sunday's performance of the Gershwin Piano Concerto and more. Well, Joyce, tell us a little bit about the Gershwin, because you're just getting started. The season is just getting started with you and with Gershwin, which I think is a pretty cool way to start our Being Americans series.
Gershwin's Concerto in F it's really an optimistic statement to American music. I think it really travels somewhere from that very first note. And I really do feel like it elevates the mood and sets everyone on that instant journey to Gershwin land that no one else can create. It's a really fabulous piece to play because I actually get to have fun. I don't have to worry, and it's not like a sacrifice of the pianist for 30 minutes. I sit, and it's a wonderful journey for me. And of course, it's the first concert, so very exciting. I hope I don't do a bad job. There's, of course, that in the back of my mind, but you can't think about that during the concert. It's it's time to make music and have fun.
I know that every note, every single note is written out, but the Gershwin piece doesn't work unless it almost sounds like there's a lot of improvisation in it. And do you work extra hard to make sure that it sounds as if you're making up parts of it as you go along, or to give it that improvisational jazzy feel?
I think because we practice it so much, the surprising things, the humorous things, and the strange things just become kind of normalized after a while, and you feel like, oh, yeah, of course, that's how it goes. It goes after that. But you do have to remind yourself that, for example, in the third movement, when the piano enters, I enter in the wrong key. It's kind of like I made a colossal mistake when I'm off by one note. And then I go into kind of a frenzy trying to find the right key. And that's my first entrance. And when you don't actually think about that, you feel like, okay, new key, I enter. You know, it becomes an obvious thing. But you constantly do have to remember of those instant thoughts that you had when you listened to it really for the first time. And it is really unfolding the piece in the most improvisatory way possible. And I think that with every performance, of course, we don't improvise with notes, but we do it with energy levels. And I play like if no one ever heard this piece before, and this is the very first time they're hearing it, how would I present it to them?
And of course, there are some people for whom this will be a first. I mean, you never know who's going to be out in that audience, but there's got to be first timers that are just popping in.
Yes. And then regarding memory also, I think to myself, worst comes to worst, you know, what we do is try to improvise, and nothing uglier than classical musicians trying to improvise like jazzers. But I think to myself, if I improvise, it'll probably end up in Gershwin land somehow, because that's what I've been practicing. So that's how we calm ourselves down.
Well, speaking of calming yourselves down, it's interesting you mention that, because at the convocation just a couple days ago, Alan Fletcher was talking about nerves on the stage, and you've brought it up twice already in this conversation. So tell me what you do with your nerves. Do you use it as an energy source? Do you have ways of kind of calming it down, or how do you play with that aspect of your human experience?
Yeah, that never goes away. I mean, it never becomes easier. This so-called stage fright or nervousness is always there, and that's what makes live performance so much more exciting and opens magical new doors for me. But I think acknowledging when that nerves hit on stage, you have to say, "Welcome, nerves. Nice to see you again. Like, we've been through this before. It's like it's our another day together." And it's not trying to get rid of it, but putting a casing around it so it doesn't go out of control and swallows you whole. It is a dance with that voice, and with that nerves, there come the insecure voices too that tell you like, oh, this is the part you always mess up. Don't mess up this time. It's really a dance, and it's remembering that those voices exist weeks, days, years before. I think that's when it's most important to have those voices with you in the practice room. They shouldn't only appear on stage. I should have those voices in the practice room and say, where are they going to pop out? I can make a good guess. And so that makes practicing process that much more worth it. And you're actually spending time on things that take away from those nerves on stage. And I think that's what's important through many, many performances. That's the thing I learned, to create the atmosphere of the concert in the practice room so I can actually conquer those demons.
Now, you mentioned that the Gershwin is not as hard as some of the really tough piano works that have been written by some of the more sadistic composers. But I'm wondering, you've got Rachmaninoff on your recital, and I just a couple days ago I saw a cartoon, I think it was on Facebook, where somebody said Rachmaninoff must have had 16 fingers on each hand or something, and they had this, you know, this monstrous octopoid hand on each side. How do you cope with that? Because he was a real bear of a composer, and also very strong, and had a big wide range on his hands and everything. So
I think it would be better if I had slightly bigger hands. My hands mm-hmm. are sort of medium-sized, and mm-hmm. I don't have great complaints about them, but they could be maybe bigger by about quarter of an inch reach more. Then I would be able to play big chords with tenths, so starting on C, past the octave, and two more. If I could reach tenths very easily, then I could pretty much play all the Rachmaninoff repertoire, I think. But I still need to compensate with speed, roll them as quickly as possible, almost together, so then the audience has an illusion that they're hearing the big chord instead of a sort of this roll. So it takes challenge, and all those roars need a little bit more work because they're incredibly uncomfortable to do a roll like that instead of just a block chord and with assistance of gravity just dig into the piano. You know, I have to go sideways in order to sweep across as fast as possible. So it's a challenge, but you got to work with what you've got.
Right. Well, you must love him, because I've heard you play Rachmaninoff several times in the past, too. What draws you to Rachmaninoff as a performer?
I think he knows the piano really well. He knows how to write for the instrument and what colors piano can have other than being percussion instruments. It can mm-hmm. be lyrical, but it can't be as lyrical as a voice or a violin. We try our best, but we can't sustain notes. It dies right away as soon as we strike them. So there's a way to writing melodies for the piano. I think that is a skill in its own, and he knows it so well. Mm-hmm. And there is a power to embellish and color and shade with all different lines, which makes his melodies for the piano just soar above everything. Like it's a whole string section rising above. There's something magical about his piano writing, and his climaxes, I think, are so clever and so in tune with human psyche and emotional states. And it's something that is so viscerally correct that you just can't help but be moved.
Well, I can't tell you not to worry or not to be nervous, but I will tell you that you're very loved here, and our audience is really looking forward to hearing you play these next couple concerts.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
We've been talking with pianist Joyce Yang about her Sunday performance of the Gershwin Piano Concerto. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program exclusively on Aspen Public Radio, where we talk with the musicians, composers, movers, and shakers at the Aspen Music Festival and School. I'm Chris Moore. Support for summer classical music programming on Aspen Public Radio is provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. You can listen to previous interviews on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
It's almost 3 o'clock, and it's time for Marketplace. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting at KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale.